for listening to Filmed in Canada. It's a podcast with bite, zest, and sparkle about Canadian films.
Sounds refreshing.
Sounds like Doritos.
Mmm.
Shiny Doritos.
I'm William.
I'm Alexander.
I'm Chris.
And we're going to be talking about a classic Canadian movie. A bona fide classic. A well-respected, pioneering movie.
Bona fide.
Bona fide.
You say bona fide.
I did say bona fide.
Yeah.
How should you say it?
I think bona fide.
Uh-huh.
Hmm.
I don't
How about
know
undisputed?
That.
Undisputed classic oh, of Canadian cinema.
Agreed.
Yeah. It's 1970s going down the road. One of the poster child examples of the stillbirth of Canadian independent cinema.
Right.
How did that sound?
Sounds great.
A little.
Do you want to explain this nonsense that you're speaking?
I was playing with like the birth of independent cinema, but
right.
Canadian cinema as sort of an independent industry never really took off. So
right.
It was stillborn in the 70s. So Going Down the Road was lauded by mainstream U.S. critics like Pauline Kael and Siskel and Ebert, praised for its grittiness, its cinema verite, and can you believe that was 50 years ago?
No.
Yeah.
No, I can't.
It's a long time. Well, technically 49, so.
Well, they filmed it in 69.
Ah.
So. And by the time this gets posted, it's it might be 50 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to talk about like how it stands up as a classic, and certainly how it is invaluable, I think, as a time capsule.
Mm-hmm.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, here we go.
We're in it.
I guess also worth mentioning at the top that it is number 6 on the top Canadian films of all time. Top 10, even though it's technically 11 movies on the list because there's a tie in the final spot. That's a list that TIFF puts out, and I think they update it every 10 years or so. The most recent entrant onto the list was 2012 Stories We Tell on the 2015 list.
Okay.
Do you want me to give a plot synopsis?
Do you want to give a plot synopsis,
yeah.
Chris?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Okay. The film starts out with some still shots of rural Cape Breton, where these two characters live. And I think if you look at those opening scenes, it almost looks like the rural American South. I mean, that kind of poverty,
mm-hmm.
It feels like they're in the Appalachian Mountains. It does not feel like a Canadian town to have that profound level of poverty. So there's... But just by showing the stills, you understand these guys have to leave Cape Breton. There is no work. There is no industry. There is no way that they can stay in Cape Breton and possibly make a living.
Mm-hmm.
So these two gentlemen decide to head out for Toronto, the big city, where kind of like the Grapes of Wrath, you know, just head west and that's where the land of milk and honey is. And Toronto will be filled with opportunities for them to get great jobs and great apartments and great cars and probably some loose women.
Mm-hmm.
So they head out in their Impala to Toronto. But unfortunately, Toronto doesn't offer a lot of opportunity for them. They are uneducated. The only work that they can get is in a bottle factory. The work is seasonal. They get laid off. I mean, and then one of the guys gets his girlfriend pregnant, so he has to marry her. And they just get more and more impoverished until they actually just sort of get kicked out of their apartment, their flop house, essentially,
mm-hmm.
and head out west for further opportunities and abandon the pregnant woman.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very sad and melancholy story.
Stand up, guys.
Yeah. But also, what are their choices?
I mean, they could, like the one guy could take responsibility for the assault that he commits and make sure that his friend doesn't go to jail so that he can take care of his child.
But it's a desperate time. Like, you're going to keep making bad decisions because you don't have any opportunity to make good decisions.
Yeah.
When you're poor and uneducated, you will likely make terrible decisions.
Yeah.
Most of the time. Because it's just hard to make a good decision.
I think what you, Alexander and Chris, are are talking about right now is whether the film gains our sympathy for the characters. So I think, Chris, maybe you have more sympathy for them.
Absolutely.
Than Alexander does.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, specifically the choice for someone to abandon their child like that, that seems a step too far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit then. So yeah so it is a story of these guys who are don't have a lot of opportunities, don't have a lot of choices, and they make some pretty desperate decisions are forced upon them. Right? Mm-hmm. So let's back up a bit. So they come from Nova Scotia, and I think something, just some historical context. Nova Scotia, the main industry post-World War II was the coal industry. And in the 50s and 60s, it really took a nosedive. So in 1950, Nova Scotia produced 6.6 million tons of coal. Compared to 1971, they only produced 2 million.
Wow.
So there is, in the background of these characters, there is the diminishing prospect of jobs in Nova Scotia. And when we see Joey leaving his, it looks like a rural farmhouse or something.
That does not look like a warm and inviting place. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is some serious poverty.
Yeah. But he's also leaving, it looks like, his mother or some relative. So she's going to have to fend for herself. So, I mean, right from the get-go, we are seeing that they make decisions to hopefully find a better lot for themselves. They never talk about, like, I'm going to send money home to my grandmother or whatever. Mm-hmm. They just,
no.
We got to go make some money for beers. So Joey and Peter, they are looking for self-preservation, I think, in the decisions that they make. Peter, played by Doug McGrath, and Joey, played by Paul Bradley. The actor, Doug McGrath, is 35 years old at this time, and Paul Bradley is 30. Do you think that their characters, Peter and Joey, are supposed to be in their 30s or younger?
Yeah, I think so.
I would say like late 20s. I mean, they're definitely a more weathered 30 than a Vancouver person would be.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They look like, you know, it's a lot of stubby beer bottles, a lot of smoking cigarettes.
A lot of mileage on their faces.
A lot of mileage, yeah. Yeah.
But I would have guessed that they were supposed to be younger as well. Just because, like, to be willing to just pick up and go, I would think is sort of a younger perspective.
But at the same time, it seems clear from the outset that it's from a place of desperation. Mm. And so that feels like a place that you would get to later in life.
Oh, okay.
That you have no options, so you need to go somewhere else.
Sure.
As opposed to, like, this uplifting, optimistic, let's make it in the big city kind of thing. Mm. Which I guess I'm mixing up the names. The blonde one is
Peter.
He, I guess, exudes more of that optimism or ego, I guess, in sense, because he applies for the job at the advertising agency early on and mm-hmm. has this sense that he can sort of fake it till he makes it, but is met with the harsh reality of what it means to not have an education and not be able to just kind of bullshit your way through.
Yeah, that's contrasted by Joey, who seems like he's willing to take an entry-level job because it means he has a job.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who pulls Peter into working at a bottling factory.
Yeah. But it's also interesting how that dynamic shifts over the film, because then later on when Joey has a dependent essentially in his wife, who is going to be out of work soon, and he loses his job, he doesn't really seem very motivated to get out there and pound pavement and get back on the line, so to speak. Whereas Peter sort of takes up the reins of accepting their fate and deciding, okay, this is what we're going to do, and I need to make sure that we survive here.
I think that's why they have very complementary personalities, which is I think why they stick with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The story was written by William Frewitt, and the screenplay is by William Frewitt and director, producer, editor Donald Shabib. Donald Shabib is from Toronto. He went to U of T, and then he did his film training at UCLA. He worked for the NFB and CBC. He had some short films under his belt when he made this feature. And how independently made is this? So he gets a grant from the Canadian Film Development Corporation, which is the early version of Telephone Canada. And then he wrangles up his own money. According to IMDb, the budget for this movie is $80,000. He tells the story that it was a crew of him and three people who shot this film. They had about 20 shooting days over a 7-week span, and they did it without permits, without insurance. And they bought that car for $100.
Is that right?
Wow.
Yeah. So really made it on the cheap. So because of his documentary background, certainly he wanted to, I think it's coming from a place where he wants to tell a real story. But of course, this is a fictionalized account and made up characters. But do you think that he has sympathy? Well, not, actually, well, I'll answer it myself. I think Donald Shabib and the other writer, William Fruitt, I think they have sympathy for these characters, but I think they can't help but betray a little bit of contempt for them.
How would that manifest itself? Like, what? Where do you see that?
I think they fail to make the decisions that bring them out of their plight. I think especially the fact that they're not educated. I think that is perhaps like the character flaw that keeps them in their socioeconomic status, right? Like they can never get out of that. They're not going to go for retraining. They are going to spend all their paycheck on booze. It's perhaps a reality that that the writer and director saw in Canadian society at that time, but they don't. It doesn't to me feel like it is entirely hopeful. I think it's hopeful in its humanity that these two guys will stick together, but it's not hopeful that they're going to actually improve their class.
No, absolutely not. I think this movie is very much about class, and you know, we like to think we don't have a caste system, but these people were born poor. They will die poor. They will die with, you know, the faces that look like they have that many miles in the saddle. They will die in their mid-50s, and they will die lower working class. There's no opportunity for them to step out of that mm-hmm. caste.
The working title for the movie, before going down the road, was simply The Maritimers.
Oh, interesting.
Well, I don't want to read too much into that, but it's a bit of a more generic title. Yeah.
But I think it does reflect that migration. Shabib was, as you said, a veteran documentary filmmaker. He was working at CBC, and he had conceived an hour-long documentary about the labor migration from Atlantic Canada to Ontario after World War II. So to call it The Maritimers is just the experience of, like, that's where everyone from the Maritimes, because the cod fisheries dried up, there's no mining in Nova Scotia. All the jobs, essentially, resource-based jobs, dried up in the Maritimes. So whether it's Newfoundland, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, everyone went to Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Both of my grandmothers both moved from Newfoundland post-World War II, and I'm assuming it would have been part of that same migration.
I never really
gave thought to that.
Big city slickers don't understand is, when you live in a small town like that, it is a one-room school that only goes up to grade 8. If you want to go to high school, you have to go to a different community. Certainly it was like that in my mother's upbringing in the Ottawa Valley. So you can't dismissively say, well, these guys should have not dropped out of high school. Going to high school was this extra thing that was going to be hard. Mm-hmm. And their families probably, it would be nice to have more income coming in. So you just get a job at 14 or 15 so that you can contribute to the household. And it's a pain in the ass to go to high school because it's not even in your own community often.
Right.
So for those guys, it's not that they're just, you know, lazy
yeah.
or unintelligent. It's just going to high school, see, it was kind of an elite thing to do. It isn't something that everyone just got a chance to do.
Mm-hmm. You guys were talking about how it's a movie about class. I also feel like it's a movie about I don't really know how to put this or like what to compare it to necessarily, but just like people who are sort of destined to be together or like can't get away from each other kind of thing. Like it feels like in a way that there's a certain point in the film where it seems like Joey is sort of on this upward trajectory and, you know, he's got a new apartment, he's got the color TV, and it feels like things are getting better for him, but he loses his job because Peter, I don't know that we see what happens, but he lips off his supervisor or gets in a fight or whatever it is that gets him fired.
I think it might be seasonal. Well, they got hired in the summertime and then they said, come back in a few months and we might rehire you. So I got the impression that people drank less ginger ale in the wintertime.
Right.
So that they lay everybody off and then rehire them seasonally.
Okay, because I was kind of confused because I thought there was a line where Peter actually, or Joey says to Peter, like, you know, why did you have to say that to this guy or whatever? Like, I got the sense that they were fired because of something that Peter had done, but I must be mistaken in that.
I do remember a line where Peter says, like, after they got laid off, I think he says, like, yeah, I should have told him off, or you should have told him off. So yeah. I think there's a should have in there.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Regardless of that piece that I kind of misunderstood, it feels like they would be better off without each other, and yet they keep coming back to each other and are sort of relegated to this existence where they have to sort of feed off of each other and force each other into these compromised positions and situations, but then also be supportive at the same time. And so it's a constantly shifting dynamic, but one that feels dysfunctional, I guess.
Codependent dysfunctional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Codependent is a good word. Yeah.
It reminds me of both Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck, and of Mice and Men. There's sort of a George and Lenny thing going on there too, where they can't not be together, but being together means something's always going to get fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
So that I was thinking about of Mice and Men a lot while watching this one as well.
Mm-hmm.
Chris challenged me, I think, on my use of the word contempt for the characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Well, if I can return to that, I'm not sure if I fully answered your question or justified my position. But the other thing that struck me about how Peter and Joey go about their work, especially Peter, is that they don't take any pride in their work. They know that they're doing shitty work for shitty pay.
Mm-hmm.
Joey, though, seems delighted that he gets $80 a week.
Yeah.
but even when they are delivering the flyers, doing a paper route essentially, and they're doing it together and they seem happy, the next thing they do is they chuck the rest of their papers because they don't want to finish delivering them. So it's just in terms of like wanting to respect the characters for at least their work ethic, we're frustrated in that regard. So I think that's why I think the film, while it likes to show their camaraderie, and it likes to embrace the fact that these guys are good together, it can't help but show that they are not going to make their situation better, just like as maybe it's just their nature, I think.
That they'll always self-sabotage. They'll always submarine anything good that happens.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's what I meant when I say like the film can't help but show a little bit of contempt for their class. Maybe that's a bit harsh, but jeez, Chris, that's really harsh.
I'd like to talk about the DOP, Richard Leiderman, who shot documentaries, including one that I think you guys have talked about on the podcast, Alan King's A Married Couple.
Yes.
So he was the DOP for that.
Nice.
And there were shots, especially at the beginning when they're just leaving Cape Breton, that looked Terrence Malick beautiful. There's that scene where Peter's sort of leaning, smoking while they're, I think, changing a tire or doing something that looked like Days of Heaven. I just thought it was so gorgeous. Yeah, so that shot was very sun-kissed and beautiful, had a bit of an Easy Rider feel to the way it was shot. And then all the guerrilla filmmaking that happens, like on Yonge Street,
yeah,
was just incredible. Mm-hmm. I just thought they did such a competent job with an $85,000 budget. It was very effective.
Yeah, that was one thing that was kind of unfortunate in watching it, was just that the DVD transfer, at least the one that I saw, was really not up to snuff by any means. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so it was hard to appreciate the quality of the filmmaking there. Yeah.
Can I ask, actually, I'm curious about how you watched it. You watched it on DVD.
Yes.
Was it the Seville Signature Collection DVD?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how did you watch it, Chris?
On the YouTube.
On the YouTube. Was the frame more square or more wide?
More square.
Okay. And was it closer to a monochromatic type of picture? Because you described the scene where the change of the tire is very sun-kissed.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So there's... you don't remember. You took a deep breath.
Yeah, no, I did. I feel like I can't make a comment on that. I don't know.
Okay, well, I only bring it up because there's two DVDs of it. Well, one is from Seville Pictures from like 2000 something, 2006 or something. My eyes are not what they used to be. 2002, which was purported to be the preservation print that was made for Library and Archives Canada.
Oh.
Which I think that's what's on YouTube, maybe,
okay.
But I'm not entirely certain.
Okay.
Yeah. Which preserves its 4x3 framing. Is that how you saw it, Alexander?
No.
Oh.
I saw this DVD, but yeah. When I played it, it was in 16x9.
Because I played this one, it was 4x3.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah. And then because there was a sequel called Down the Road Again, made in 2000-something. Anyway, this DVD is pressed in 2011. But in time for the DVD release of Down the Road Again, they had a restoration of Going Down the Road, which had more saturated colors. And they formatted it. They reformatted it for widescreen by cutting off the top and bottom of the screen.
Mm.
And for that, Alliance, fuck you. Like this. Like I think it's.
How
I think
is that
it's
a restoration when you're actually butchering something? That's not a restoration.
It's not a restoration. It's a different version, but
that's
it's
a
not
cut
a restoration.
Job.
Yeah, but I think and so there's a documentary on this disc about the restoration, and the guy points out like long time ago they used to colorize black and white films, and they thought it was good, but their technology was shitty. So now we have better technology to colorize. But but he's done the same thing by cutting off the top and bottom to make it widescreen.
Oh, like, man.
So anyway.
Ugh.
Anyways, an aside.
Yeah.
Well, it should have better treatment if it's number 6 on TIFF's list.
Well, we talked before about how there's not really any formalized effort to preserve Canadian films.
That is true.
No. Yeah. The people in the background, so because they didn't get any permits, there's people in the background who are just real people.
Oh, yeah. Those people at the Salvation Army hostel, they didn't sign a waiver. They were just like, I'm just sitting here being sad, so you can film me being sad.
Yeah.
Or later in the movie when they are, there's sort of street musicians drinking wine.
Yeah.
Those are just real musicians I was reading. So I think things just, and all that Young Street stuff. I mean, maybe in the record store, they perhaps closed down just one floor of the record store for that scene. But everything felt guerrilla for that.
Yeah.
And I have to say, Toronto looks incredibly sexy in this film. I think because...
Like dirty sexy, though.
Sleazy sexy,
okay.
You know, because everyone's from a small town.
Hmm.
So your brain must have exploded coming from these tiny little towns in rural Canada, because the entire country is rural in 1970. There's like 4 cities.
Yeah.
It must have just blown people's minds to go to Toronto. The neon lights, the go-go dancing, the, a record store. You could see how novel it was for them to walk into a record store and to be able to like, pick a record and put it on the turntable and play it before you bought it. I mean, this is all big city stuff.
That's an iconic location there, Sam's.
Sam the Record Man?
Yeah.
So in the movie, it's A&A Records.
I remember A&A.
Did that become Sam? Or
It looked a lot like Sam's to me. Yeah,
the same location.
On Young and Dundas there, yeah.
Yeah. You grew up in Toronto.
Yes.
Alexander.
Yes.
So when you were growing up, like what part of Toronto that's in Going Down the Road was still around?
I wouldn't say that I recognized a ton of the locations, to be honest. I grew up in Toronto, and I was relatively close to downtown, but at the same time, like, I didn't necessarily just wander around downtown on my own as a teenager, and I never lived there as an adult, really, so I don't have, like, a really good map of the city in my head kind of thing, so I don't know. While I'm from there, it doesn't necessarily always... I don't get that nostalgia necessarily when I see it in a movie. Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
I did go to that beach with my nephew and his husband, that when they have a picnic and the girls are wearing curlers.
Oh, yeah.
And then they go to the cliffs, mm-hmm. and they're on that, the bluff. Mm-hmm. I think they're called the Bluffs or something, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, did a day trip there as well.
Nice.
The record store. I enjoy visual metaphors in movies, and I don't know if it is just a happy occurrence or if it was intended, but I liked how I liked the orchestration of the record store scene.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take it apart a little bit. So
yes.
Looks like it's Friday night. They're spending their paychecks, and the gang from Bottling Factory goes to this record store in the downtown, and then one of them says, like, come on, guys, the country music stuff is downstairs. And they head downstairs. But Peter, he spots this cute girl who's going upstairs, and he follows her to the classical record section. So Peter is this guy who has ambitions to be upwardly mobile. And so he physically he chooses to go upstairs while his friends go downstairs. And I think that's a very nice cinematic thing to do.
Absolutely, and yeah. It's aspirational. Like the girl that he follows is this delicate, beautiful, kind of slightly hippie chick who probably took violin lessons, which is why she, or plays the classical piano, which is why she puts on a classical LP. So it's an aspirational, like, this would be the girl that I would date if I was just the next class up. This would be the type of music I would listen to if I was just the next class up. Mm-hmm. But as a working class person, I'm not going to get that girl, and buying this album is as close as I'm ever going to be to a fancy man.
Yeah.
Are you guys familiar with that piece of music?
No.
Yeah, because I've heard it. I don't know if it was on a podcast that I listened to a lot or something, but it's just, like, very clear in my mind that I've heard it a number of times somewhere. And I looked at the IMDb page for the composer, and nothing was really ringing a bell, but I don't know.
The fact that they would have paid for music clearance seems almost unlikely on an $80,000 right. budget, but...
I recognize it, but I can't tell you the name of it right now.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's just because I think I've heard it in other movies or in TV commercials. I almost thought I'd heard it in... do you remember the French movie Chris Diva?
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's The Pearl Fisher. It's an opera by Bizet, I think.
Okay, then that's not it at all. That's not it at all. Yeah.
Right. Well, I worked in a record store, and so the two things people always ask for were the soundtrack to Harold and Maude and the song from Baghdad Cafe and the song from Diva. And they were always really hard to get.
Hmm.
Yeah, the piece, it's called Gymnopédie. I don't know what that word means in French, but...
I can picture it written
on... Who's the
on...
composer? Satie. I think Eric Satie.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I just have a very vivid memory of hearing it somewhere, and I can't place it.
Mm.
But it's a good piece of music.
I think this plays into Peter being... the more cerebral, Like, I don't know if Joey will ever be unhappy with his life, because I don't know if he has the capacity to be self-reflective about his life or his lot or anything like that. Whereas Peter is inward gazing and does have aspirations to get out of the class that he's in.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way Joey has the sort of cerebral bandwidth to think about that or mm-hmm. or to be disappointed by it.
Mm-hmm. And yet Peter is the one who sort of puts them in a very compromised position at the end of the film and sort of relegates their fate to really never being able to get out of that life, because, I mean, whether they make it to Vancouver or not, the clock is ticking, I think.
Hmm. So it was Joey who clobbered the guy.
Yeah, but it was Peter's idea to yeah. steal the groceries.
Yeah.
And caviar. I think that's very telling as well.
Yeah. With
stealing caviar.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
Yeah, right? Oh, that's true.
Yeah. The factory that they work at, or the bottling plant, Wilson's Ginger Ale.
Is it a real thing?
Yeah, Wilson's Ginger Ale was real.
So really?
they got permission to film there, probably
wow.
also without paying a lot. Wilson's Ginger Ale was a private company, family-owned company, 1875 to 1973. Then it was sold to Crush International. And then the brand fizzled out 1985.
Seemed very self-satisfied with that pun.
One of the slogans was, "Here comes the fizz." Joey Slinger in the Toronto Star lamented in 1985 that Wilson's Ginger Ale was full of bite, zest, and sparkle. Where I pulled that from earlier.
Circle.
And it was like, I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing because I didn't write it down. But he said it was something like, it's like your mouth putting on its dancing shoes.
Oh my god.
What did you feel about the sexism in the bottling factory?
Mm. Oh my
well,
god.
And elsewhere throughout most of the film.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
they decorate their apartment with just shots of boobs and beef.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like that's their decor, is just pictures from nudie magazines plastered in their shitty apartment.
So in the context, in the 80s, my parents ran like an independent grocery store.
Yeah,
and it was porn. No, sorry. So what you did when you ran a store back then was you'd have to physically go down to the warehouse and get your stock. Like Dairy would deliver, or your Coca-Cola would deliver, right? But if you just wanted cans of this and that, you went down to the cash and carry or the H.Y. Louie, and you picked it up. You filled your truck and came back.
Okay,
right? The wholesaler. Anyway, so sometimes I'd go with him on a run and pick up stuff. So at the warehouse, if you wanted to use the washrooms, it's of course past the staff area. And when you walk back there, if they left the lunchroom door open, you would see inside there. It was plastered with porn.
Yeah.
In the lunchroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've even seen that like these days as well. I working in real estate, like a lot of the industrial listings that we have, I'll go through a space and like at the shipping office at the back of the warehouse,
right.
there's just yeah. wow. maybe not necessarily porn, but you know, like more kind of
like swimsuit calendars?
FHM magazine
okay, yeah.
stuff or whatever.
Right.
Like
it's
that.
A bit toned down these days.
Yeah.
But when I saw like the way they were decorating their apartment, it brought back memories of when I was younger and noticing in the adult world, there are places that are for men.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's a scene where, I can't remember, her name's not Nicole. Is it Nicole? The French, Sophie, the French woman who works at the plant?
I think it's Nicole, yeah.
Okay. And they actually say, what a pair of knockers on her.
Yeah.
Which is another thing you often don't hear in the workplace these days.
Again,
depends which workplace, right?
Yeah.
Workplace I'm a part true. Of is definitely yeah. prone to that sort of talk.
Yeah.
Well, the sexism, I think there's just very conventional roles that men and women play in this world. And I'm not saying necessarily that's the lower class world, but I'm somewhat suggesting that's just a part of being in this conventional role. So the women are kind of shrewy. They smoke. Betsy gets pregnant. The other one just talks nonstop. They're both waitresses at a restaurant.
Peter's constantly complaining about how much
Peter's constantly complaining. She, you know, smokes through her pregnancy, drinks stubby beer bottles during her pregnancy. So the men are supposed to take care of everything, and the women are supposed to look good and, you know, I guess put out if you need to.
Yeah.
Making out in cars. Do you think millennials do that? They get an Evo and then they go make out in cars. Like, that is such a distinctly 1970s and 80s thing to do.
My girlfriend and I were making out in cars a lot when we were first dating because we weren't.
Oh,
like,
that's good to hear. I'm glad it's not a dead art.
So it's got to start somewhere, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Good. Glad to hear it. I wasn't ready to say goodbye to that. I was looking into when the pill was invented and trying to figure out why Betty, how she got pregnant. I mean, I understand how she got pregnant. I understand the science of that. But were there other options? And I think that there's always just a lot working against you as a female.
Yeah.
Like, it could be a religious thing. It could be an inconvenience thing. It could be it's not readily available to go on the pill.
The guy doesn't want to wear a condom.
Yeah, so.
Because that's obviously his choice.
Yeah. But I was actually quite moved by Joey's wedding speech.
Yeah.
You think of him as just kind of a soused hoser, you know, kind of always a bit drunk and a bit goofy. And he gives this quite sincere and heartfelt speech that he's really going to try and do right by her.
Mm-hmm.
And that he loves her. You can see that she's like, oh, please don't say anything. You're just going to embarrass me because you're drunk mm-hmm. and sloppy. But he actually kind of wins her over with that speech.
Based on where the movie ends, I would say that that is a good example of the failure of the institution of marriage. Because people can say whatever the fuck they want.
They sure can.
They need to follow up those words with actions.
Right. And does it feel a bit like The Big Short that Joey can go in and get all that furniture on layaway? Like, he furnished 3 rooms in his apartment.
Yeah.
That TV was $500. You guys, $500 in 1970?
Yeah, when they're making $80 a week.
When they're making $80 a week?
Yeah.
So someone sold Joey, you know, a bill of goods too. Like, oh yeah, you can afford this. You just, you know, you don't even have to pay for it till October. It'll be fine.
Well, that's the same. I mean, like the Brick or any of those big furniture stores, like they're, from what I understand, they make more money off their debt financing than they do off the furniture itself.
Is that right?
Yeah, because, I mean, it's 0% down, and then,
right.
you know, no payments for 12 months, and so people forget about it, and then it's like, oh, shit, now I have to fork out $300 a month, and I can't make those payments. So,
right.
Yeah. Is this the 6th best Canadian film of all time?
I don't know where it lands, but I think it's probably one of... actually, let me walk that back a bit. I think if you were to make a list of like the definitive examples of Canadian film, this is certainly this would, like, without a doubt be on that list.
Right.
I don't think I'd watch it again myself.
Right. So furthering that logic, is this best Canadian films list really just the most Canadian films list that TIFF puts out?
I think so. Isn't that how it's designed to be? It's designed to be the premier examples, right?
Well, no. I think it's the people voting on it are
they decide
intended to choose their favorites or what they think to be the best, whatever, not necessarily what's the most Canadian.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I think among filmmakers, there tends to be high regard for people who are the auteurs, who do something unconventional, who do something that bucks the trend. And so I can understand why this is one of those movies that's held in high regard because of how it's made, what it stands for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does that answer this?
I think so.
Now you answer that question. Do you think it belongs on the list?
I mean, I thought it was well made. Like I said, not having a great visual representation of it It's hard to sort of fully appreciate all of its merits, but
what if it was?
I'd say it's among the better movies that we've watched for this podcast.
Okay, all right,
put it that way.
All right.
I definitely think this film deserves to be there. This is my second time seeing it. I was really looking forward to watching it again. It exceeded my expectations from when I saw it 20 years ago. Just a memory of it feeling very inexpensive and, you know, this sort of picaresque tale of these two buddies leaving the Maritimes for the big city. I think it's a really important Canadian film, and I think it's just an important film. I mean, Pauline Kael was comparing it to Cassavetes, and I think you said it was the death of independent Canadian film. Like, if we...
I said it was the stillbirth.
The stillbirth, yes. So because of all this tax credit nonsense, we just started making a lot of low-budget, shitty movies. What if we were making more movies, like Going Down the Road, and we would have this whole sort of Cassavetes, neorealism, cinema verite, French New Wave thing going on here in this country? Mm-hmm. This could have been the catalyst for a whole new, you know, medium in Canada. But this was it. We didn't do anything after that. Then we just, okay, you get a film from Telefilm Canada. Here's your $3 million budget. We never made a movie like this again. So does it deserve to be there? Hells yeah. It's a very significant film.
Going down
and
the road again.
Yeah, and I will watch Going Down the Road again just because. I know.
I would say that Hardcore Logo has similar qualities to it.
I mean, if you look at Bruce McDonald's first couple features that were like micro budgets,
yeah,
those definitely felt more sort of guerrilla filmmaking. But I think the subject matter just feels very Cassavetes, whereas Bruce McDonald has always been kind of cheeky and irreverent.
Right.
This is just real storytelling.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't feel like we ever got there again. Right.
Influences, or how it influenced. American Graffiti begat Happy Days. Would we agree?
Yep.
And so I posit that Going Down the Road was the inspiration for Laverne and Shirley.
What?
And we'll do it our way, yes, our way, make all our dreams come true.
Just me and you.
Okay.
I'm a lot younger than you guys, so.
Well, anyway, the Laverne and Shirley was a sitcom about two girls who worked in a bottling factory.
Hmm.
Yeah. But that came out in 1976. So I guess I posit that the interest in workers at a bottling factory maybe originated here.
Do you think there's still that level of shitty jobs in the world? Like in the world that we live in when we just consume a lot of garbage? Like that job in the bowling alley?
Yeah.
Who is going to do that job? And did you see that his coworkers? Those people really had that job.
Yeah.
They looked ropey and tough as fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. You describe the scene. Like, describe the scene for listeners.
Oh my God. So before we had automated pin fixing, once you throw the bowling ball down the alley, people manually reset the pins.
Yeah.
So all the shit's crashing at you. You're resetting the pins. You got a cigarette plugged into the side of your mouth. And you are resetting pins in a bowling alley work.
But you'd also need to be aware enough of the game as to like how many bowls had been bowled and
sending the ball back. Oh my God, it looks like the worst job. So I thought the bottling job looked terrible. The bowling pin job, the worst. Like what? Are there jobs that are like that level of shitty?
I've had a paper route. And I think I did a better job than these guys.
Yeah.
But
I would hope so. The bar was pretty low.
Well, the newest industry is like the whole,
I guess working for Amazon.
Zero waste. Well, I was talking about like how we're aiming for a zero waste society. And we put all our garbage in separated bins. Those go somewhere where someone separates them again cleans them. So they're shitty jobs.
But I mean, whether those jobs exist in Canada necessarily, I don't know, but there's certainly all kinds of manufacturing jobs in other countries where you're just you're just putting together plastic fasteners thousands of times a day, one of the ones that we talked about for this podcast, Manufactured Landscapes. There's footage in that movie of workers there just slaving away, doing the same repetitive task literally thousands of times a day.
Let's wrap it up. So SCTV parodied this movie in 1982 with their short Garth and Gordon, Fiona and Alice, where they really poke fun at the protagonist's optimism about going to Toronto to find jobs. So it's John Candy and I think it was Joe Flaherty. One is a doctor and one is a lawyer. And they're like, Gord, did you hear there's lots of lawyer in jobs in Toronto? Is there doctor in jobs and lawyer in jobs? Just ready for us to pick up? Let's go to Toronto and get some lawyer in jobs. But I didn't know that the Nova Scotians were considered country bumpkins in Canada.
Everyone's a country bumpkin. We've got four cities. In whatever that CBC program that runs Saturday morning, Because News, one of the intros is Canada, home of 10 downtowns, which is about right. There's literally 10 downtowns in this entire country. This is not a country that is has a very high population. I mean, most of us do live in cities, but everyone's a country bumpkin.
When you put it that way, Chris.
I've lived in Labrador. Yeah. Bumpkin.
So we're rating and comparing this movie to The Big Lebowski, I thought of, which is a very stylistically different movie, but specifically in the dynamic between the two main characters and their codependence, that kind of made me think of the dude and Walter. And I guess their social standing, etc. But actually, Chris, when you made mention of Terrence Malick, it did make me think of Days of Heaven, actually, as a good comparison point.
Oh. Sorry, I haven't seen Days of Heaven.
No!
Oh, come on!
Do you have my Days of Heaven disc right now?
I think I returned it.
Okay. Oh, yeah, you did. Yeah, because so
I'd like to borrow it again.
Yeah.
Maybe we could pause this while I watch it, and then I'll come back and give it a rating.
Yeah. And then you had also suggested Crepes of Wrath and Of Mice and Men, but I haven't seen those.
And Midnight Cowboy was suggested by William, but you haven't seen that.
Oh, okay. And you probably haven't seen the Hong Kong film Happy Together. But
Wong Kar Wai.
No, I have.
You have?
The gay one.
Yes, right.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I did see that.
Hmm.
Sorry.
But not a three-way... that is, we don't have a movie in common that we've seen three ways. Huh. Except The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
I guess we'll have to go with The Big Lebowski. So you're comparing them basically about the relationship between the two men.
Yeah, but also just the I guess social class that they exist within and
And bowling.
I don't know that there's necessarily all that much ambition for upward mobility, but there's a bit. I mean, the dude wants his rug back, so.
Seems like more than what Peter and Joey want. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's money going around.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Big Lebowski -3.
All right. I'd go Big Lebowski -6.
That sounds about right for me as well.
All right.
I do want to note that it did win Best Original Screenplay, Best Feature Film, and then the two actors shared Best Lead Actor between the two of them for the award.
At what awards show? Is it the Geminis?
God, what would it have been in 1970?
Yeah.
It might have been...
I think IMDb just said Canadian Film Awards. I'm not sure if that was the actual name.
Maybe that was the name of it in the 70s, yeah. And now it's the Geminis? Or the Leos? No.
Leos is Vancouver specific.
Oh, okay.
Genies? No, what's Genies?
No, Genies sounds right. Yeah, Junos are the music. Genies are the film and television, right? Or film?
No, no. Like 2 years ago, they became the Canada Screen Awards or something.
Wow.
Yeah, whatever. I'm sure someday they'll hit the branding right, and people will pay attention.
And Doug McGrath was in two other movies that we've talked about on the podcast: Porky's and Black Christmas.
Mm-hmm. And he's still around, so maybe he'll be upset with what we say about him. All right. Well, that wraps up our talk about Going Down the Road. The sequel is called Going Down the Road Again, but shouldn't have been Going Back Up the Road?
That's true.
Anyways. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're getting kicked out of the studio, so...
Hi.
Hi.
That's it for us.
Goodbye.
We're getting early.